From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is Evan Fowler.
Good afternoon, Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network sitting in today for Tony. Glad to do it. Haven't been in the chair for a while, and privileged to be able to sit in for Tony and help out today. Glad you're listening today, this Friday afternoon. We've got things move fast. We have lots of topics. In fact, we just had a change of topic just a little while ago. Let me give you the lineup here. In our first segment, we'll be talking with Representative Andy Harris, 1st District of Maryland, about the push for D.C. statehood. What's that all about? At 5:20, 22 minutes after the hour approximately, Leila Gilbert, FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, will talk with us about Christian persecution in Nigeria and Turkey's aggressive ambitions in the Middle East. In our segment at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking about a California bill to fund gender transition surgeries and hormonal therapies. We'll be talking with a real expert, pediatric endocrinologist Quentin Van Meter. He's also the president of the American College of Pediatricians. And in our last segment at 40 after the hour, we'll have two separate guests. We'll be talking about a couple of topics. First of all, and this is the topic that kind of changed our schedule because it just happened this afternoon, a federal judge ruled unconstitutional New York City's policy condoning mass protests but banning religious worship services. Of course, that's been happening all over the country. Chris Ferrara with the Thomas More Society will be with us. And then second part of that, Travis Weber. You've heard from Travis a number of times on Washington Watch. He's FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs. He'll be talking about that, but also about a case in Tennessee where the HHS resolved a situation with health care triaging that discriminated against the elderly and disabled, a very important situation there. So let's get started. Well, with the country in chaos, as we wade through racial tensions, record unemployment rates, and the coronavirus, Democrats want to focus on the statehood of D.C. That seems to be their priority. The District of Columbia was founded to be a neutral ground, but the House has passed a bill to make the U.S. Capitol the 51st state. Joining us now to talk about this is Representative Andy Harris. He serves the 1st Congressional District of Maryland. Andy, good to have you on the broadcast today.
Oh, it's good to be with you this afternoon.
All right. Well, first of all, give us a little background on this this D.C. statehood thing. We've heard it bouncing around for quite a while, but what's the significance of it, and why are the Democrats making this a big priority right now?
Well, the bottom line is this is all about partisan politics. They want two additional senators. We know it's about partisan politics because the last time Congress decreased the size of the District of Columbia was in 1847 when they gave the land back to Virginia that Virginia had given to the district, to the federal government. So the right approach, really, if you want to do this, is just give Maryland's land back. You know, keep Federal Triangle, keep the White House, keep the Capitol grounds, but give everything back to Maryland. But that's not what this agenda is all about. It's about getting two more liberal Democrat votes into the U.S. Senate.
Not really a big surprise right now. You know, it seems like the Democrats are doing everything they can to tip the election. And I'm going to ask you about another one of those things that wasn't necessarily on the agenda here, and that's about mail-in ballots and some different things like that. So give that a little bit of thought as we can continue to talk about D.C. statehood. What are some of the arguments for and against D.C. statehood?
Well, there really is no argument for D.C. statehood. There is an argument for either giving D.C. residents the ability to vote on taxation with representation, and that, of course, can easily be done by doing retrocession back into Maryland, and they become Maryland citizens and have a representative in Congress. Or what's also been suggested is you just don't ask them to contribute federal taxes, which is done in all the other territories. So there are two solutions that don't require statehood. Clearly, D.C., the District of Columbia, it was envisioned by our founders to be a very special entity, and statehood is just simply not appropriate.
Does it make any sense? And I have no idea here, but does it make any sense to even continue to have the district? What was the original purpose of the district, and is it something that it even needs to continue as it stands now?
Well, I think you do, because what's unique in the United States is that we actually have a federal enclave. You know, a lot of foreign countries, it's just one of their cities is a capital, and they have a capital building. But we created a system where that federal enclave is separate from any state. cannot be, no state can therefore have undue influence over the federal government by the fact that the federal government exists within that state. So it's actually a very good idea. And again, just by eliminating federal taxation, you could eliminate the issue of taxation without representation.
Yeah, so it really, to turn it into a state would almost negate its original purpose, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, and that's why statehood is just not an appropriate solution. Again, you could shrink its size. You could move a lot of its residents and their land back into Maryland. But keeping the federal enclave separate is very important. We saw good examples this week when Lafayette Park, the outskirts of which is controlled by the Metropolitan Police, would literally be the federal enclave, and the White House would be surrounded by another state. And when that happens, bad things can happen, especially if, like we saw, that jurisdiction doesn't want to enforce laws and vandals and destroyers against the federal enclave.
And I'm going to ask you about that here in just a minute, too, once we sort of get all this D.C. statehood stuff taken care of. Well, obviously, that the House, it's Democrat majority. That's probably why it passed. So obviously, when it goes to the Senate, it's not going to make it there. And certainly, if it got through the Senate, the president wouldn't sign it. Would you agree?
Well, not only that, it's likely unconstitutional. I mean, the Constitution sets very specific guidelines for how states are to be formed and approved by Congress. And even if the Senate agreed, the president signed it, I believe the Supreme Court would overturn it as an illegal and unconstitutional move.
It seems like a lot of folks are ignoring the Constitution. Was the Constitution even considered when the Democrats put this bill up for a vote?
Well, they claim incorrectly that this is just like what happened in 1847 when Congress decided to shrink the size of the District of Columbia, but it did it by giving the land back to Maryland. It didn't create another state at the time. That's a very key issue in this argument. So I think they just disregard the Constitution. They know this is just a political statement. They know this is not going anywhere.
Yeah, well, yeah, it does. It sounds like they changed the definition of what happened back then. It's nothing like what they want to do now. And here's the thing, too, is, as you said at the outset of this conversation, it would grant them two United States senators for this really tiny little enclave. And even that is unconstitutional, isn't it? Because it wouldn't be a state.
Well, but again, Congress thinks they can somehow declare it a state, even though the Constitution it doesn't fulfill the criteria of a state. So the whole thing is just a political statement. And really, America looks at this, and in the context of what's going on in the Capitol right now, and the lawlessness and the inability of the government of the capital city to enforce the law, I think this is the last thing on people's minds right now is, gee, we think D.C. deserves statehood. They've behaved so well.
So they're making a political statement. And do you think they have, obviously, they'd like to see this pass if they had majorities in both houses as well as in the administrative, the executive branch. It would pass, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, but there are other issues. For instance, the 23rd Amendment, which gave the district three electoral votes. The only people left in the federal enclave, according to this bill, are the occupants of the White House. Now, let's say it's just a president and his wife. What you end up is you don't even have enough people to fill the number of electors you need under that amendment to the Constitution. So it's just convoluted. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, they're very good. All right. So let me shift here to the whole issue of the election, because that's what this is all about, is trying to flip the election or at least to load up the Senate with a couple of more Democrat senators, because likely that's what they would be based upon the makeup of those who live in the district. What are your thoughts about mail-in voting, whether that's even makes any sense, and how much potential for fraud is there?
Well, the potential for fraud is tremendous. We know that because the Carter-Baker Commission, again, former President Carter was part of that commission, said that mail-in balloting is the most ripe for fraud form of voting. And we saw this in spades in Maryland with this last election. We saw it in when Baltimore City, 1 week after the election, still had tens of thousands of uncounted votes. Now, who knows where they were? Who knows who was controlling those? We had problems with getting ballots mailed out, ballots returned. We had thousands of people who literally were deceased got ballots because we weren't allowed to purge the voter rolls. This is just ripe for fraud.
Is there any way, and I know there's the 10th Amendment, and each state kind of takes care of its own methods of voting, but is there a way, or would there be a way to set all of this right, for instance, to have a national voter ID requirement? And, of course, people say that those who are opposed to voter IDs, I think, are people who really want to be able to cheat in the elections. They claim that it's going to disenfranchise particularly minorities, but nobody ever talks about the fact that if you don't have voter ID, it's disenfranchising, if there is voter fraud, it disenfranchises legitimate votes from legitimate registered voters. Talk about that for a minute.
That's absolutely right. And, of course, voter ID is very difficult when you have mail-in balloting. So I think the majority of Americans realize that voting is the right to vote is very important. I think the majority agree that voter ID is not unreasonable. But, again, I proposed when I was in the Maryland State Senate, and it's just like you said, they said I wanted voter suppression. You know, this was a racist move. That's nonsense. The bottom line is I think every American with the right to vote should vote, and every person in this country who doesn't have the right to vote shouldn't vote.
Yeah, absolutely. So back to my original question there, is there any way to true up the voting system across the country, or is it sort of you got to do it state by state, city by city?
Well, technically, the federal government could, in federal elections, define how votes are to be held, but that would become very cumbersome because, of course, city and local and state elections are held simultaneously. So you'd really want one system. So it's very difficult for the federal government to mandate a specific voting system because, honestly, the Constitution leaves these decisions up to the states.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it would make sense that everybody would require photo voter IDs to make sure that the people who are voting are the right people. But we know that there are lots of people who don't want that kind of accountability because it makes it a whole lot easier to cheat. Last thing I want to talk about here in the last couple of minutes, Representative Harris, is your thoughts about what's going on in D.C. Even this afternoon, as a matter of fact, it's right now as we're recording this, we're live at the moment, but some folks are going to hear this later, delayed. It's 5:17 Eastern time, and last night there were threats to take down this statue of the Emancipation. I believe it's the Emancipation statue. I don't know exactly the correct title, but it's a statue of Abraham Lincoln with a freed slave. And the radicals, the rioters, the Antifa folks, who whatever you want to call them, have vowed that they're going to take this thing down. What's the status, as you know it, at this moment? Because they said they didn't do very well last night because the president brought in National Guard and so forth. Where are we now on that?
I think the president and the president's chief of staff are quite adamant that that will not occur, that if necessary, they will bring in people again tonight. They want to keep it nonviolent, but those statues should stay up.
Well, absolutely, and for a variety of reasons. If we're going to be taking down statues and other symbols like that, people in the communities that have them should have a reasonable conversation about why, learn about the background of the people that are being portrayed in these statues instead of this crazy anarchic kind of stuff. Well, Representative Harris, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, we'll be talking about Christian persecution in Nigeria and Turkey's aggressive ambitions with FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, Leila Gilbert. You're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. We'll be right back after this break.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership and Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
Well, hope you're having a great Friday afternoon, even in this country where we have lots of turmoil going on. Hope that you're spending extra time on your knees praying, because that's what we need to be doing right now, right? Great conversation there with Andy Harris, the representative from the 1st District of Maryland. This is Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network sitting in today for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. Well, many in America are caught up in the turmoil across the country, but we can't forget. We cannot forget about the atrocities facing our Christian brothers and sisters around the world. It's going on all the time. Nigeria remains a hot spot for Christian persecution, and it looks like Turkey is going out of its way to harm people of faith in a new military offensive. Joining me now to talk about all this is FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, Leila Gilbert. Leila, good to talk with you.
Nice to be here. Thank you so much.
All right. Lay out for us. We've talked about Christian persecution on this program many, many times. And as I said, it goes on all the time. It's been going on for a long time. It's really sad. And we've got brothers and sisters who are being killed for their faith. And tell us what's going on. Let's first of all talk about Nigeria and what's happening there, if you would.
Yes, well, Nigeria is really looking like a genocide that's taking place as we speak. And it's one of the most, it is actually the worst place in the world for Christians. And the problem is that it's very, very difficult to get accurate information about the bloodbath that's taking place. But tens of thousands of our Christian brothers and sisters have died there at the hands of radical Islamist terrorists.
And who? What's the government of Nigeria doing about it, if anything?
The government is possibly complicit with this, at least certainly doing nothing. The president, one of the two groups that are the most active are the Fulani herdsmen, they so-called, which are terrorists. The president of Nigeria is of that same tribe. And there's reason to believe that he's certainly turning a blind eye, if not making this possible. President Trump has spoken directly to him about the problems that Christians are having with slaughters, and he sort of nodded his head and did nothing. So it's a very alarming situation regarding the government there and regarding the lack of capacity for the U.S. to step in, because we don't have enough people making our government aware of this. This is very important that we keep our government aware of what's going on there.
So you say that the president is, our president, is aware of what's going on and has spoken directly to Nigeria's president. What kind of leverage do we have over Nigeria, whether it's foreign aid or other things, where we can put, you know, put some heat on them to straighten this out?
Well, yes, and that's a very good question. We have to have good documentation. We have to have leverage with the State Department, and Mike Pompeo's aware of this. Getting accurate reports out of the State Department is very important. Having cooperation with the embassy there is very important. You know, these things are sprawling bureaucracies, and they don't always pay attention. So our goal is to just keep it in front of everybody and let the president and Pompeo and everybody else know that we're watching it closely.
Well, yeah, and you say we need documentation, but I'm asking this question somewhat sarcastically. How many people have to die before they pay attention and do something about it, right?
Exactly. And you know, the problem is it's an African country. There, after these attacks happen, villages are burned to the ground. People run away. It's very difficult to go in and get, you know, a Harvard law school approved facts in a bloodbath. And so what we really need is more direction toward getting precise numbers and getting them in front of people that will wake up and say this is, in fact, a genocide waiting to happen. We saw what happened in Rwanda. We saw what happened in Iraq. It was too late to stop it. And we're trying to make sure that people are aware of what's happening in Nigeria.
And once again, it seems to be the same formula, radical Islamists attacking Christians because they don't like their faith, right?
Well, yes, and they actually, it's beyond not liking their faith. It's wanting to eliminate them and create an Islamist regime. And so they're literally, it's trying to destroy the entire Christian culture in certain parts of Nigeria, and I'm sure they want to just do it in the whole country. Half of the population, sort of, in Nigeria is Christian. It's not, you know, that they're a huge minority, but they... territories that these Islamists have targeted are primarily Christian, and they're just going systematically place to place, and then we hear about it.
Wow. Well, Leila, we just have a couple of minutes. If you would touch on Turkey, what's Erdogan up to now?
Well, interestingly, one of the most recent reports I saw was that he is providing arms to Nigerian militias, radical Islamist militias, of course, but he's encroaching on five or six other countries as we speak. He's really trying to create some sort of a neo-Ottoman empire or an Islamist regime, whatever you want to call it. And he's not being taken seriously, it seems, by many places, including maybe the U.S. And we need to make sure that people are aware of his nefarious behavior across the Middle East and beyond.
Well, he's even reached into Israel, has he not, or tried to?
Absolutely. And just this week, there was a report that the Muslim Brotherhood-related group there on the ground is trying to seize power over the Temple Mount and over the communities that are Muslim and trying to create a pushback against the Jews. And, of course, we know what the Muslim Brotherhood thinks of Jews.
Right. Well, what are some things our listeners can be thinking about or praying about with regard to both of these situations?
Well, the first thing I think people can do is seek information off of the web, off Christian posts. That's where you have to get most of it because the mainstream media doesn't publish it. But also, write to your representatives and let them know you care. And, of course, write with people.
Briefly also, what are the other three or four countries that Turkey's involved in here? We have about 30 seconds left, Leila.
Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Greece.
Very good. Well, Leila, thank you for the good work that you're doing. We appreciate it. Thanks for your time this afternoon. Well, coming up, we'll talk about a California bill to fund gender transition surgeries for children and adults. Believe it or not, they're wanting to set aside taxpayer dollars to do this. We'll be talking with Quentin Van Meter. He's a pediatric endocrinologist and also the president of the American College of Pediatricians. You're listening to Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Not so long ago, sex education in public schools involved learning about human growth and development and listening to advice on how to be careful, respect others, and save sex for marriage. Things are very different today. Parents have two main concerns about sex ed: that it sexualizes children and that it's loaded with LGBTQ indoctrination. Family Research Council has released a new resource to address this issue titled Sex Education in Public Schools: Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This resource reveals troubling examples of the agenda-driven content being pushed in modern sex ed and exposes the powerful organizations behind it all. Finally, it offers some action steps for parents to consider in their fight to protect the health and innocence of their children. For more information about sex education in public schools and to view this resource, visit frc.org/sexeducation. That's frc.org/sexeducation.
Back to Washington Watch on this Friday afternoon. Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network sitting in for Tony today. Glad to be here. Well, the California Assembly has voted to set up a taxpayer-funded pool of money to pay for minors and adults' surgeries and hormone therapy that will permanently destroy their reproductive systems. Not only are the tax dollars being used poorly, but children are now even more at risk to treatment, and that's in quotes. It will change their lives and their bodies forever. They shouldn't be making these kinds of decisions, and their parents shouldn't be signing them up either. Joining me to talk about this is President of the American College of Pediatricians and Pediatric Endocrinologist, Quentin Van Meter. Quentin, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be with you. Thanks.
All right. Well, first of all, as I read there at the beginning, this thing has passed in California, apparently. Tell us a little bit about the bill and what its intention is, and then I want to get into a little bit of endocrinology, if we can, because that's your specialty.
Sure. The bill is proposed to allow funds in the state of California to be spent specifically to promote the transgender agenda, lifestyle, support groups, medical treatments, so that kids who identify themselves as being born into the wrong body, as they would call it, can have access to essentially resources for all of their wishes and all of their needs. So this was something that is presented as a solution to a problem for kids who are suffering with the thoughts that they are born in the wrong body. Mm-hmm. The problem with that being that this is a non-biologic situation. It's an opinion of a child who is not mature enough to make decisions legally and until the age of majority, which is age of 18 in most states. And they're allowing children instead to make a decision at age 5, 6, 7, 11, or 12 that they wish to receive treatments and for this condition, both socially, medically, and then eventually surgically, to attempt to create a body that is of the opposite sex, which is biologically impossible.
So I want to ask you to give us a kind of a layman's level understanding of what has led to this. Now, there's something called gender dysphoria, as I understand. There are situations, and it's, I guess, very rare. Give us a little bit of schooling. Take us to medical school here again at the layman's level as far as how much this actually happens, and then how much of this is societal and cultural?
Well, the concept of being feeling you're born into the wrong body has been around for a long time, perhaps a century. It did not really come forward until the late 1960s, early 70s, when the group from Boston and the group at Johns Hopkins came together and decided that they wanted to take adults and change their bodies to look like the opposite sex. That was called transsexualism at the time. The program at Johns Hopkins was closed down in the early 1980s because the outcomes in those adults showed that there was no improvement whatsoever in their psychological undercurrent morbidity. That is to say, suffering from what they thought that was causing their problem and their desire to be changed, if you will. So the program was shut down and in the United States, and particularly at Johns Hopkins. I was a fellow in pediatric endocrinology at the time, and we were very familiar with the faculty member who was responsible for running that program and promoting it. So there's a latent period from the early 1980s until 2007 in the United States when Dr. Norman Spack from Boston brought back a concept and started a clinic for kids who believe they were born into the wrong body. And that, by this time it was called gender identity disorder. And it was recognized as a disorder. The treatment protocols for that were initially social transition and medical transition with hormone therapies, usually waiting until the age of consent, and then surgery only after the age of consent. So that's how we got where we are. It is not biologically based. There is absolutely no provable biology to say you are born into the wrong body. There is psychological morbidity in literally every single one of these patients who believes their life solution would be to become a person of the opposite sex, that all of their anger, all of their frustration, all of their anxiety and depression is all based on the fact that they believe they're born in the wrong body. As it turns out, in the studies of from Europe, where we have one study from Sweden, doing all of this treatment essentially did nothing to resolve the morbidity, psychological morbidity. So that's where we are in terms of experience. We know that it doesn't do what they're hoping it would do.
It makes it worse in the long run, doesn't it?
It ends up making the suicide rate 20 times greater than the general population. So we know that as a fact from an unbiased study of 100% of the people in Sweden who had the diagnosis. Problem is that the incidence of this was like 6 out of 100,000 males and 3 out of 100,000 females in the original statistics from around the world. So a rare condition. Now we understand, based on the statistics coming out, that it's now as high as 3% of the population are concerned that they're born in the wrong body. And this is a social contagion phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I've got about less than a minute left. Very quickly, from a letter that you sent to the folks in California, you said the vast majority of gender incongruent persons who are allowed to go through the entirety of puberty realign their gender identity with their biologic sex. So in about 10 seconds, what does that mean exactly?
That means that if you let this child have the support emotionally that they do need and guide them back to being congruent with their biologic sex, they are essentially perfectly healed in the vast majority of cases. So
So we'll just wait it out. Well, thank you very much, Quentin Van Meter. Appreciate it. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes for our final segment.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership and Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
Into the home stretch for the week and the home stretch for today's Friday edition of Washington Watch. Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Glad you're listening. Last segment here, we're going to be talking about something that just happened this afternoon. The streets have been filled for weeks in the wake of George Floyd's death at the hands of police brutality. Our next story, though, is not about demands for justice from protesters, but an injustice being done to the church in New York. A federal judge has ruled a New York City policy condoning mass protests, but banning religious worship services is unconstitutional. Joining me now to talk about this is special counsel for the Thomas More Society, Chris Ferrara. Chris, thanks for joining us today and helping us out with this topic.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
All right. Well, first of all, lay out what the requirements were, what the mayor of New York and the governor of New York were trying to impose on churches and not others.
Well, this is a case, to quote Judge Ho in his concurring opinion in the Fifth Circuit, a case of leaders and people in power and government declaring freedom for me, but not for thee. So what they were doing was approving mass protests over the death of George Floyd, which is classic First Amendment protected activity. People have the right to do that. And also Black Lives Matter protests. There were also Juneteenth celebrations in the thousands. All of this is classic First Amendment activity. The only problem is it contradicts the entire regime of social distancing, which they claimed was necessary to save lives. Well, nothing is more risky in terms of spreading a virus than 5,000 people or 10,000 people marching across the Brooklyn Bridge, which they had no problem with. So the double standard basically dealt a death blow to their social distancing regime, both outdoors and indoors. Outdoors, they were attempting to limit gatherings that they did not favor, namely religious gatherings and others, to 10 people in the lower half of the state, in New York City area, or 25 people in the North Country near the Canadian border. At the same time protesters were marching in thousands in Brooklyn, the police were kicking Hasidic Jewish children out of a local park. So the disparity was just intolerable. The judge saw that this was a double standard that could not be sustained under constitutional scrutiny.
Yeah, and Chris, just for the record, you know, you talked about the First Amendment protection and protests, and that's true, absolutely, if you're peaceful, that you're a protester. But we've also seen a lot of non-protected activity called rioting, and we've people, you know, again, hundreds, maybe thousands in the street committing illegal criminal acts. Again, same thing. They're out there in large groups close together, and you have some so-called leaders who are actually saying that that was more important than even than the safety precautions that they were imposing on other people, like churchgoers and so forth. So you have a combination of First Amendment-protected protest and non-First Amendment-protected rioting, burning, and criminal activity. But it seems like leaders across the country, in some cases, in certain areas, think that's just fine. Well, so tell us why it was ruled unconstitutional. When was the case brought? Who were the plaintiffs? And when this case just was decided upon today, wasn't it?
Yes, it was this morning. And the case was brought by two Catholic priests who have parishes in upstate New York and three practitioners of Orthodox Judaism in Brooklyn. The case was brought in the Northern District because the governor resides in Albany, and so that's a proper venue under federal law. And what we were arguing is very simply that people should be treated equally, regardless of the purpose of their gatherings. You cannot cabin religion in a 25% indoor occupancy category, religion alone, when all the other businesses and entities that are allowed to operate in the state are at 50% indoor capacity or 100% indoor capacity. The disparity was just indefensible. There's no basis for it other than anecdotes and superstitions about how houses of worship are somehow viral danger zones, unlike supermarkets, bagel stores, offices, and even restaurants. In the North Country now, restaurants are at 50% capacity. They're allowed to have tables of 10 separated by 6 feet. And, of course, at a table of 10, people are facing each other while eating, talking, laughing. What could be riskier in terms of spreading a virus? So the activities that they were allowing are not different from indoor religious gatherings in any meaningful sense that involves public health. And the judge saw that. So he said, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Indoor religious gatherings should be on the same level as secular indoor gatherings. So yeah, at 50% in phase two and whatever it ends up being in phase four, 50% over 100% is potentially exposed religious gatherings in the other businesses and entities in phase two will be at 100%.
Yeah,
so now it's just a simple matter of equal treatment.
So will this enable people in New York City to attend church again, or might they crack down and place restrictions on everybody again?
Well, who knows what they'll try to do. They could claim there's a spike. And I'm very alarmed by the media coverage of the rising number of cases, as they call them. There are more cases now than ever before. What is a case? I'll tell you what a case is. Cases, they test somebody and he tests positive. But so what? He's not in the hospital. He's not dying. All they're doing is uncovering the development of herd immunity, which is what happens with every virus. So fear-mongering continues in the media as if the sheer number of people who have the virus justifies locking them down again. The only reason they're getting it now or that the cases are being discovered now is that they were locked down before. So unless there's a dramatic rise in deaths or hospitalizations, this is all just media hype once again.
Yep, that's you took the words out of my mouth. Well, I want to shift to FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, Travis Weber, as we continue to talk about New York City's discrimination against places of worship. Travis, you want to comment about that case before we move on to the Tennessee situation?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a positive result that we're seeing out of New York in terms of a ruling that deals with the issue and protects religious liberty in the right frame of analysis. We've often seen a lot of approaches among judges, other government officials, and the public's understanding of religious liberty in the age of coronavirus and the restrictions we're facing. A lot of the approach has been ill-informed, and it's good to see a judge that properly tackles the issue and and protects religious liberty constitutionally. We need more of this type of judging, this type of approach in these cases and other religious liberty cases.
Yeah, and Chris, I'd like to ask you to comment on something here, too. Early on in New York City, and you may be aware of this or familiar with this situation, but one of the folks, I don't recall his title or his name, but he was involved in the health department or management of the public health efforts in New York City, was encouraging people to go out on the streets of New York and go into Chinatown or whatever and just have a great old time. And then we also have heard some things about the governor's policies with respect to nursing homes. And it sounds to me like, you know, New York was the big hot spot across the country, many, many more deaths than in any other part of the country. How much of this, and, you know, either one of you can comment on this, but how much of this was due to extremely poor leadership from government officials, specifically de Blasio and Cuomo?
Well, what we have so far is a preliminary injunction. That's an interim relief as the case moves forward. And assuming it isn't fully resolved by agreement or otherwise, there will be discovery proceedings, and we're going to delve into a lot of these questions. And one of the questions we're going to be asking is, what did this lockdown in New York State really accomplish? Did it actually prevent deaths from COVID-19, or did it actually cause deaths because of the lockdown, especially in nursing homes? My own father was the victim of a lockdown in New Jersey, very similar provisions by Governor Murphy. They locked him into his nursing home. Somebody got infected with the virus. No one could leave. No family members could come in. He could not be provided with extra water that he needed to avoid being dehydrated. He got dehydrated. His kidneys failed. He ultimately died of kidney failure. Hmm. They're claiming it was a COVID death. And that's what's happening in New York. They're locking people into these homes. They have many comorbidities. Statistically speaking, many would have died within a year anyway. And then Cuomo himself said something, I think it was back in March, to the effect that maybe it wasn't the best health policy to confine everybody to their houses where the old people were getting infected by the younger people. He actually said this. And then much more recently, he said, isn't it strange that 60% of the people who are infected were infected indoors, which is where he forced them to stay.
Right.
So we're going to be looking very seriously at the whole paradigm of the lockdown, which seems to me to be coming into bold relief, not as a public health measure that prevents deaths, but as a way to grab power. And we see this in the way that in many of these cases, not just New York, the governors involved have issued little changes in their executive orders during lawsuits in an effort to try to moot the claims of the plaintiffs, which shows that they're just manipulating their executive orders to avoid being scrutinized by courts. So what is this? Is this a game, some kind of grudge match, or is it really all about public health? Well, I think you see in New York that if it was about public health, certainly isn't any longer, because with thousands crowding plazas and bridges and screaming at the top of their lungs and being in very close proximity, not even 1 foot apart, but shoulder to shoulder, any pretense that this is all about saving lives is right out the window. It's not about saving lives. And I maintain, and I think I'm going to try to prove, that it never really was about saving lives. They might have thought it was at first, but they certainly can't think that now.
Well, and very sorry to hear about your father and what happened in his case. But pleased to hear that there's going to be more discovery and hopefully some of the truth about the way so-called leaders in not only New York, but perhaps some other states have made some pretty poor calls. Well, Travis, let's shift gears to another situation in Tennessee. Tell us about what happened there with this HHS case.
Yeah, so this is a agreement reached by the state of Tennessee with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, Office of Civil Rights, which is charged with enforcing federal civil rights in this context, including, you know, on a number of bases, including a prevention of disability discrimination, making sure that people are not discriminated against based on disability or age. So basically, out of concern that some of the approach that the state of Tennessee had taken with regard to its crisis standards of care, health care, and the impact they would have on people based on disability or age, HHS, OCR investigated and reached an agreement with Tennessee to revise its plan to make sure that the state was not treating the elderly and disabled unlawfully, illegally, and in a manner that would violate the law. And this is important because, you know, there'll often be attention by a lot of the press and others on certain activities, the pro-life or religious freedom actions taken by various government officials in the Trump administration, including HHS. And HHS has been fantastic in terms of pro-life and religious freedom policies. But they're also doing good work making sure that people are not being treated unfairly and unlawfully because of their disabilities or their age. This is a matter of human dignity. It's good to see HHS, the Trump administration, HHS proceeding with this policy mindset. This needs to be celebrated, and people need to know that this is the Trump administration that's taking these actions in accord with human dignity, all people deserving treatment because they have value, because they're human beings, not because of the utility that they bring to a society or to a system. So this, you know, this development is not going to get a lot of attention probably in a lot of the press, but it is very significant. It deserves to be commended. It's the fourth resolution that HHS has agreed to with a state, the other states being Alabama, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania, a resolution to ensure that people are treated fairly and not unfairly because of their age or disability.
Yeah, let's get into kind of the practical application here. I scanned the article from HHS on this ruling, and correct me if I'm wrong in terms of interpretation here, but essentially this is a situation that was they were trying to set up some guidelines when everybody was concerned that there would not be enough ventilators, for instance, across the country. And if you had so it was one of those situations where if you had a shortage of ventilators in a particular area, in this case Tennessee, that somebody would have to make a decision as to who gets the equipment, right? And then they were essentially leaning more toward the Ezekiel Emanuel in the Obama administration model where, well, if you're old and infirm, you're not as useful as the young people, so the young people are going to get the medical care. Am I interpreting that kind of correctly?
That's the gist of the concern here, and that's why these types of enforcement actions by HHS OCR and the director, Roger Severino, are so important. And Roger's work there at OCR has been fantastic. It's been consistent with life, family, and religious freedom, the matters that FRC is focused on in federal policy. And, you know, the gist of the issue that you described there is why we need to understand what's going on here, pay attention, because what OCR is doing, simply ensuring that everyone's treated fairly, not discriminated against based on age or disability. They're mm-hmm. doing this with religious freedom. They're doing this with life and conscience. People have conscience objections to facilitating abortions. Yet, you know, where is the attention on this from the mainstream media when they're happy to jump on the case, jump on this and focus on it when it deals with other issues? This is a story that needs to be told, and we want to commend the administration for this, and everyone needs to know about it.
Well, you know, elections really do make a difference, and I've been very pleased to see how pro-life HHS and the Secretary of HHS have been. It's very, very important. That's why this next election is really important. Well, Chris Ferrara and Travis Weber, thanks for joining us in the last segment. This is Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins. Thanks for listening to the Friday edition of Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.